2 Samuel chapter 4, a reward for unrighteousness. 2 Samuel chapter 4, let's stand in honor of reading the Word of God. When Ishbosheth, Saul's son, heard that Abner had died at Hebron, his courage failed, and all of Israel was dismayed. Now Saul's son had two men who were captains of raiding bands. The name of the one was Baanah, and the name of the other was Rechab, sons of Rimmon, a man of Benjamin from Beeroth. For Beeroth also is counted part of Benjamin. The Beerothites fled to Gittaim and had been sojourners there to this day. Jonathan, the son of Saul, had a son who was crippled in his feet. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel, and his nurse took him up and fled. And as she fled in her haste, he fell and became lame. And his name was Mephibosheth. Now the sons of Rimmon the Beerothite, Rechab and Baanah, set out, and about the heat of the day they came to the house of Ishbosheth as he was taking his noonday rest. And they came into the midst of the house as if to get wheat, and they stabbed him in the stomach. Then Rechab and Baanah, his brother, escaped. And when they came into the house, as he lay on his bed in his bedroom, they struck him and put him to death and beheaded him. They took his head and went by the way of the Arabah all night and brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron. And they said to the king, "Here is the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life. The Lord has avenged my lord, the king, this day on Saul and on his offspring." But David answered Rechab and Baanah, his brother, and the sons of Rimmon the Beerothite, "As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life out of every adversity, when one told me, 'Behold, Saul is dead,' and thought he was bringing good news, I seized him and killed him at Ziklag, which was the reward I gave him for his news. How much more, when wicked men have killed a righteous man in his own house on his bed, shall I not require his blood at your hand and destroy you from the earth?" And David commanded his young men, and they killed them, and cut off their hands and feet, and hanged them beside the pool at Hebron. And they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in the tomb of Abner at Hebron. This is the word of the Lord. You may be seated. Through selfish, murderous, conniving, and deceptive actions of men, God has worked to bring his servant David to the throne of Israel. And though it is yet to be acknowledged throughout all of Israel, particularly at this point, just Judah, the reader again sees that nothing can thwart what God has promised. David indeed is to be king over all Israel, and the unrighteous affairs of men cannot frustrate the will of God. He has sovereignly assured that though the actions of these characters remain utterly sinful and rebellious, they would work in concert to get David to the throne. It's much like a foolish soap opera as we remember what has occurred. Remember, the author has told us that David's strength had been increasing while ruling over Judah from Hebron. And we learn that some of this was due to some of his own actions, like his marriages to multiple wives, some for political gain, particularly with Maakah, the daughter of the king of Geshur, and also through the reunification with Michal, Saul's daughter. We also learn that though Abner had attempted to divide the kingdom from David and establish Ishbosheth, Saul's son, as king over the northern portions of Israel, he later defects to David due to the accusation from Ishbosheth that he has took his father Saul's concubine, Rizpah. Meanwhile, Joab learns that Abner's defection led to a covenant with David, which would not only give Abner a position within the kingdom, but also assured the loyalty of the northern tribes which Abner commanded. He assured their submission to David's reign through this covenant. When Joab hears of this, it does not sit well with Joab. Joab was already resolved to avenge his brother Asahel's death, but now his desire to kill Abner is further motivated because this defector has become a rival to General Joab's position within David's kingdom. Joab's selfish purposes lead him to deceive Abner. Joab and Abishai, his brother, fool Abner, getting him to come to the city gates. And in a vulnerable moment, Joab stabs Abner in the stomach, similar to the way Abner had killed his brother Asahel. David then learns of Joab's deeds, and David pronounces a curse upon Joab and all of his posterity, calling all of what Joab and his brother Abishai have done to Abner as wicked. Now perhaps we should have expected David to do much more than simply curse Joab, but this is all he does. Because Joab's killing of Abner was not a noble killing, but an unjust killing. Yet David only curses him and spares Joab's life. We want to speak more about that today. Now we may not be able to be conclusive as to why, but it leads us really to speculate David's preferential treatment of Joab. Others who had perpetrated similar acts, as we see today, usually met their deaths by David's sword. David would write and sing a lament honoring his one-time rival Abner, and he buries Abner in Hebron. All of those informed of what David has done finds David to be innocent of this killing and are pleased with David's actions toward Abner's death. So the author ends chapter 3 showing that David's actions have helped in winning the loyalty and submission of the rest of Israel. Or many more in Israel. And now we come to chapter 4. And this soap opera continues. The author means to show us how foolish men can be, yet again how sovereign God is to assure the fulfillment of His promises. We remember how the author described this period of division. Chapter 3, verse 1 tells us the war was long, the civil war between Judah and the northern tribes, between the house of Saul and the house of David. Yet David grew stronger while Saul became weaker, or the house of Saul, weaker and weaker. Chapter 4 is given to us to show us some details signifying the fading of Saul's influence and reign over Israel. Remember, the deterioration of Saul's rule had already occurred when Saul and his three sons died on the battlefield. One of those sons was noble Jonathan. He died in battle against the Philistines. Abner, Saul's general, takes up the mantle of leadership, but he has failed. He defects to David because of his conflict with Saul's son Ishbosheth. But then he is murdered by Joab. Now more of Israel has bowed the knee to David, but not all. Ishbosheth is a weakling, but remains the assumed king over much of the north. And so chapter 4 gives us the further demise, or the complete demise, of Ishbosheth. Saul's household has its last attempt, last ditch effort to hold on to the throne, but yet fails. Now you think of a worthy successor, even after Ishbosheth. The author means to show us that there are no worthy successors. Saul had other sons. We will find that he had two sons through the concubine Rizpah, Armoni and Mephibosheth. However, the sons through slave wives, concubines, had no claim on the throne. They were not worthy in the ancient Near Easterners' eyes. It was policy that no sons of the king through a concubine would inherit the throne. So that eliminates Armoni and Mephibosheth. There was also a grandson of Saul's named Mephibosheth. He was the son of Jonathan, who we read of in verse 4. He is not to be confused with Saul and Rizpah's son, Mephibosheth. I mistakenly said last week that Rizpah was the mother of crippled Mephibosheth, but strike that from your memory banks. Joe Allen is not infallible. I made a mistake. This is another Mephibosheth. Two different ones. One, the son of Saul through his concubine Rizpah, and the other, a grandson, the son of Jonathan. For record of this, you can see 2 Samuel 21, verses 7 and 8 is proof of what I'm saying. To show the weakening of Saul's household, you have Saul's son Ishbosheth, the weakling, who is about to meet his death. And you have Mephibosheth, the crippled grandson, the son of Jonathan. Look at verse 4. Jonathan, the son of Saul, had a son who was crippled in his feet. He was 5 years old. When news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel, his nurse took him up and fled. And as she fled in her haste, she fell, and the boy became lame. His name was Mephibosheth. In the ancient Near East, such sons would also have no claim to the throne because they were handicapped, unfit for battle, which disqualified them from such rule. So are Ammoni, Mephibosheth, the sons of Rizpah and Saul, Rizpah the concubine, not worthy because sons of a slave wife. Mephibosheth, the crippled grandson, not worthy because he's unfit for combat. So the author means to show this, to emphasize all of this detail for us, including Ishbosheth's influence deteriorating. Ishbosheth knows this. Everyone else knows this. And because his general, General Abner, is dead, it is likely that Ishbosheth had no idea, given what we read here, that Abner had chosen to defect previously. So now that Abner is dead, Ishbosheth is viewed as a defenseless pawn of Abner. Now Abner is dead, and the text says Ishbosheth's courage failed, and all of Israel is dismayed. Literally, the text says that Ishbosheth's hands dropped, meaning they became slack, weak. This is metaphorical language saying that he has lost his grip upon what he was ruling. While Abner had terrified him, Ishbosheth was nothing without the strong man who had made him king. So what would become of Saul's son without Abner? This was a question the northern tribes were asking. The text says all of Israel was dismayed by Abner's death. All Israel here refers to the tribes that remained loyal to Ishbosheth. It would not include Judah or those who had defected to David at this point. All Israel was dismayed, terrified might be a better rendering. Was all Israel panicked because they saw their king losing his grip, or because they too heard of Abner's death in Hebron? Probably both. What would now become of the people who had rejected David and given their allegiance to the trembling weakling of Mahanaim? You see, they had recently been persuaded by Abner that their future lay with David. Chapter 3, verse 17. But they did not know that their change of heart had been communicated to David, nor did they know how David has responded to this news. The news that Abner had been killed in Hebron hardly suggested that he had received a warm welcome there from David. So they seemed to view Abner's death as threatening. Ishbosheth losing his grip, these northern tribes were terrified. So the author means to show Saul's household and reign is indeed becoming weaker and weaker, as fulfilling what was stated in chapter 3, verse 1. Ishbosheth is about to meet his demise, and the author further emphasizes this growing weakness by stating that the only remaining blood of Saul that would be viewed as a typical successor after Ishbosheth was simply a crippled grandson named Mephibosheth. No rightful heirs to the throne. No worthy heirs to the throne. And though the author makes no mention of them, we do note here, as a footnote, that Saul had grandsons through another daughter, Merib. Five of them, who she bore for Adriel, the Maholathite. However, they were not viewed as worthy successors who could have claimed the throne, as we will read in chapter 21 as well. Saul will have no successor from his household after Ishbosheth. The Lord had rejected him as king, and he has chosen his servant David. And though the demise of Saul's household would be through the evil exploits of men, they would work consistently with God's ordained plan for David. David is going to be king over all Israel, and there was nothing men could do to stop it, and really nothing men could do, as we will see in this text, to hasten it through wicked ambitions. It was happening, and there was nothing men was going to do to influence God. God had planned this from the beginning. It was going to happen according to God's plan. We are again reminded that no one can thwart the will of God. He is the King who sits upon the throne, and the world, the earth, is His footstool, meaning He remains sovereign over the affairs of men. What men do is often meant for evil. And like Abner, the exploits of men are in blatant resistance to the will of God. Remember, initially, Abner knew what God had promised for David, yet he would defy it as if he could stop it or alter it. As he found out, even in his opposition to thwart the will of God, his deeds only assured the will of God. There is no escaping the sovereign will of God. It is best to bow the knee and worship the Lord by serving the purposes of the living God. Resistance is futile. It will only work to assure the achievement of God's will and assure your eternal damnation. And we come to these self-serving defectors that we read of in chapter 2 and 3. Men who, in their exploits, seem to try to hasten David's universal rule or total rule of Israel, but we notice their motives behind their actions. Like Abner, there would be others under Ish-bosheth who desired to defect. While Abner defected because of the insult from Ish-bosheth, there were others who desired to defect because they are seeing the writing on the wall. David's strength is growing, Ish-bosheth is deteriorating. And so here we meet the sons of Rimmon, the Beerothite. Rechab and Baanah, verse 2, now Saul's son had two men who were captains of raiding bands. The name of one son was Baanah, and the name of the other Rechab, the sons of Rimmon, a man of Benjamin from Beeroth. And then he parenthetically inserts, for Beeroth also is counted part of Benjamin. The Beerothites fled to Gittaim and have been sojourners to this day. Now what does all that have to do with what we're going to read in the following chapters? Breaking it down, we find these men were assigned to be over groups of raiders within Ish-bosheth's rule. They went about destroying and pillaging town to town. The author means to show us that this was not a particularly promising designation of these men. Captains of raiding bands. They were described similarly to that of the Amalekites in 1 Samuel chapter 30, verse 8. This gives us a hint of the kind of characters Ish-bosheth had now put his hopes of ruling the kingdom upon. Another indicator that the household of Saul is getting weaker and weaker. The unusually detailed account of their family here, their tribe and their hometown background, emphasizes the blood ties between Baanah, Rechab, and Ish-bosheth. Rimmon, the father of Baanah and Rechab, is otherwise unknown in the biblical record. The important thing about him here in this context is that he was from the sons of Benjamin. But the details are intended to bring about disenchantment with Saul's rule within Israel. The author inserts this historical background information, and a Hebrew hearer would have taken note of this. Let me tell you what they would have heard. Beeroth, their hometown, had a curious history. Probably accounts for the details emphasizing its Benjamite credentials. In the days of Joshua, the native non-Israelite inhabitants of Beeroth had joined with those of Gibeon and two other nearby towns. You remember the Gibeonite deception of Joshua, where they dressed up like sojourners to trick Joshua, thinking that they were not inhabitants of Canaan because the order was annihilation of all the inhabitants of Canaan. So they escaped Joshua's sword by fooling him. The Beerothites were involved in this Gibeonite deception. If Rimmon and his sons lived in Beeroth, later readers of this account might wonder whether they were really Benjaminites. The narrator explains that the original Beerothites fled to Gittaim. This may have been when Saul had attempted to annihilate them. You read of this again in 2 Samuel 21, 1 and 2. Saul attempted to wipe the Beerothites off the face of the planet. This relocation, still known at the time of 2 Samuel, was written to clarify possible confusion. Rimmon and his sons, though they lived in Beeroth, did not belong to the earlier inhabitants of the town of Amorite descent, but these two actually belonged, had blood ties to the tribe of Benjamin. And so this is another dig by the author. This has been a rather roundabout way of indicating that with the death of Abner, the future for the frightened Ishbosheth depended on the likes of these two fellow Benjamites who had reason to harbor animosity towards Saul's household, because during Saul's reign, for some reason or other, the text doesn't tell us, perhaps we'll get clues of it as we read on, Saul attempted to kill all the Berothites. And so these men had logged that in their memory banks for a day, finding a golden opportunity to avenge what Saul had done to their hometown. And now comes the time. Saul's household is in a vulnerable moment. Ishbosheth and these sons of Rimmon, the Berothite, Rechab and Baanah, see a golden opportunity to take matters in their own hands and to strike back at Saul. For some time, these men may have dreamed for an opportune time. Now seemed like the time. Ishbosheth's completely vulnerable. So they cooked up a plan where they would seem as if they had come to Ishbosheth's house for wheat, posing as hungry men, hungry inhabitants of the northern tribes. The location of food storages in these ancient homes would have been in the center, near the quarters of the king or whoever owned the home. They would have been near the king's bedroom, and they knew this. The text tells us that they were able to sneak into Ishbosheth's chambers and stab him in the stomach. Another person stabbed in the stomach. For some reason or other, this seemed to be the popular method of killing people during this time. Through deception, they were able to get in close to King Ishbosheth through stealth. After killing him, they were able to escape. Then we read in verse 7 that almost seems like the author scratches what he had previously written and retells the story. But he rehashes the murder of Ishbosheth, giving us one little more tidbit of information that is significant to the rest of the passage. Not only had they stabbed Ishbosheth, but verse 7 tells us that they beheaded him. There was great purpose behind that. The sons of Rimmon take the head of Ishbosheth and travel to Hebron to meet David. They present the head of Ishbosheth to David. And look at verse 8. It is very interesting what they say. I said to David, "Here is the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life. The Lord has avenged my lord the king this day on Saul and on his offspring." Before David responds to their deeds, the author means to show how reprehensible the deeds of these two brothers were. You see, if you think of it, they did not have to resort to such evil deeds. They could have simply thrown their lot in with David. They didn't have to go and do all this. Most of the people started to defect to David. They simply just could have announced their defection and went and mingled right into the army of David and got on with supporting the true king of Israel. But they do not do that. Dell Davis writes this, quote, "These men wanted premier positions in David's regime and wanted to use Ishbosheth's head for leverage." You see, they were opportunists. Not only vengeance was on their heart, but opportunism, something for their benefit. So they cloak their evil desires or their evil motives with theological language when they come to David. Notice they say, "The Lord has avenged my lord the king this day on Saul and on his offspring." The sons of Rimmon were claiming to be the servants of the Lord in executing his justice by eliminating David's rival and solidifying David's position. They were suggesting that David owed them a great reward for what they have done, a debt of some sort, perhaps a posh government job. They have the audacity to say that through their selfish actions that the Lord has avenged David. One writer puts it this way, quote, "They come with blood on their hands, but theology on their lips, expecting that the latter will magically bleach the former. Their murder seemed pleasant because it was wrapped in religious considerations," end quote. These two brothers should give us a quick reminder that such behavior is not far from any of us. how some of us would use theology to cover sin and folly. For some, theology is not truth that lures us to worship God, but technique that enables us to justify ourselves. Dale Davis writes this, quote, "Many may recognize them in the self-appointed defender of doctrinal precision who are eager to explain, correct, and inform with all harshness and severity. If accosted about their stringent style, even on matters of lesser moment or debatable clarity, they argue theologically. They are only concerned that they hold, or that we hold, to the whole counsel of God, and the slightest indifference on doctrinal matters may begin the plunge to unbelief." So they cloak their stringent style and their haughty pride to be right on all of these matters as if they are genuinely concerned about everybody's doctrinal precision. Suppose the church elders begin informal or formal discipline against an erring or reluctant church member. What will they hear? A lot of times, theology, in that difficult duty to approach a sinning or erring brother or sister. A lot of times, their pride will swell up and cause them to defend themselves with theological language about how all of us are sinners, but God is compassionate, certainly more so than church elders who gave you the right, pastor, to assess my life anyway. We must be aware. When we explain things theologically, we may simply be using God, using Him as an argument, manipulating Him for our convenience to keep from submitting to His grace or to His law. The sons of Rimmon were perhaps using their theological language to hide their vengeance, their true motives behind killing Ishbosheth, for vengeance and taking it as an opportunistic endeavor to advance their position in David's kingdom when they defect. Certainly using it to try to win the favor and reward of David. David would have none of this. Look at verse 9. "But David answered Rechab and Baanai's brother and the sons of Rimmon the Beerothite, 'As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from adversity, out of every adversity, when one told me, behold, Saul is dead, and thought he was bringing good news, I seized him and killed him in Ziklag, which was the reward I gave for his news. How much more, when the wicked men have killed a righteous man in his own house, in his own bed, shall I require his blood at your hand and destroy you from the earth?' Then David commanded their execution, cuts off their hands and feet, and hang them near the pool of Hebron. Take the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in the tomb of Abner." The sons of Rimmon had made a galactic miscalculation, assuming that David would reward them for destroying his rival enemy. Surely David would love this if we take Ishbosheth's head and present it before him. You see, while others considered Saul David's enemy, David never considered Saul his enemy. David viewed Saul as the Lord's enemy. David viewed Saul as the Lord's anointed, his Lord the King. David desired to honor the Lord's anointed and never dreamed of harming Saul, even when he had the golden opportunity to avenge the wrong that Saul had perpetrated against David. Even while Saul was living under threat of the king, David acknowledges that it was the Lord who redeemed his life time and again out of adversity. Saul often had David cornered, but David acknowledges how the Lord intervened to spare his life. David expresses gratitude for the Lord's rescuing him from such troubles. David would not be suckered into crediting these evil men with the deliverance of a gracious God. There's a point here for us to consider. A good thing to faithfully express is gratitude for God's providence in our life. You know, one of the greatest sins of Christians is to neglect gratitude. Neglect gratitude we have for God and how He has spared us from a lot of trouble. We are always struggling with weakness and faltering of faith in our life. Praising God by often pondering and expressing gratitude for His faithful providence in your life fosters great strength and fidelity in your walk. You wonder a lot of times, why am I so weak? One of the ways to fight against weakness, faithlessness, is to exercise gratitude to the Lord, especially when He has brought us through such troubles. Gratitude nurtures fidelity. This is not just a principle for kings, but for all of God's people. It has always proven the safeguard for all of God's flock. In A.D. 155, Polycarp of Smyrna was arraigned before the authorities and required to call Caesar Lord and burn the requisite pinch of incense. You see, then Caesar worship was law. And people had to bow the knee and confess Caesar as God. Polycarp refused. The council assured him that he had wild beasts and would feed Polycarp to them if he refused. "Send for them," Polycarp replied. "If you despise the wild beasts, threaten the council, I will send you to the fire. Swear and I will release you. Curse the Christ." This stirred Polycarp's stellar response. Polycarp says, quote, 86 years have I served Christ, and he has done me no wrong. How then can I blaspheme my king who has saved me?" The words are different. The principle is the same. The result is the same among Christians. Gratitude provides an excellent antidote for idolatry. Here David stares these men down. He says, it's the Lord who will increase the kingdom. It is the Lord who has rescued me from adversity. David is giving credit to the Lord and giving thanks to God. And this would steal David's resolve and future endeavors. The sons of Rimmon were mistaken. Saul nor his household were considered by David as his enemy. As far as David was concerned, these men had unjustly taken the life of the son of the Lord's anointed. David states that Ishbosheth did not deserve death as far as it pertained to him, especially in the way these men would kill Saul's son. In fact, David referred here, interestingly, to Ishbosheth as a righteous man. Apparently, David was informed in the conversation how these men were able to kill Ishbosheth. When David refers to Ishbosheth as a righteous man, he was not referring to Ishbosheth's moral character, but referring to the circumstances surrounding his death. David says these wicked men, the sons of Rimmon, killed a righteous man or an innocent man by entering his home under the guise of need, posing as hungry men, needing wheat. Ishbosheth and the keepers of his home, they were fooled by these men. See, these men were considered as servants of Ishbosheth. They come posing as hungry men. So David is saying Ishbosheth is not necessarily a righteous man, but innocent concerning the circumstances that brought about his death. He was fooled. And he was vulnerable. He was asleep in his own bed. His killing by the hands of these men could not be justified. Therefore, David says, Ishbosheth died innocently. And then David recalled a former situation, or a similar situation. He told them of the opportunistic Amalekite who came with the news of Saul's death. By bringing the crown and armed band of the king, the Amalekite was expecting a reward from David. And whether or not David knew it at the time, the Amalekite was attempting to deceive David concerning the circumstances surrounding Saul's death. Remember, he lied. The Amalekite stated that it was he who was ordered by the king to finish off the king as he was slowly dying from his wounds on the battlefield. And that was not accurate. Saul killed himself. And the Amalekite, hoping for some reward, cooked up a story to seem as if he aided David in ridding him of his enemy, Saul. And again, David did not consider Saul his enemy, but the Lord's anointed, and so he killed the Amalekite on the spot. David states the sons of Rimmon deserve the same fate as the Amalekite. David sarcastically states their reward for their unrighteousness. He received his reward, now you're going to get yours, a reward for unrighteousness. David ordered their execution. And then we see a very gruesome portion of the text states that David had these corpses mutilated, desecrated, by cutting off the hands and feet and then hanging these mutilated corpses by the pool of Hebron for public display. Now you ask, why would David do such a gruesome thing? One commentator put it this way, quote, "There was no government statement issued bemoaning how morally outraged the king was. These fellows would never sneak or stab again. Hebron was to be a kingdom with dissection and justice for all," end quote. In other words, this would be a public display of justice and deterrence. Behavior like this would not be tolerated under David's rule. It seems that everybody is wanting to take a stab at Saul's household now and bring a piece of someone's body of Saul's from Saul's household before David to show them how loyal they are to David in hopes they would get some sort of recompense or reward from it. And David's putting a stop to it. Behavior like this is no longer going to be tolerated under David's rule. There would be justice and no tolerance for such crimes. If anyone would sneak around and deceive people in order to harm them, they better think twice because they're going to pay a stiff penalty. Not only would they be executed, but their remaining body parts would be put on display to warn anyone and everyone. Also, it's to be noted that David felt compelled to give these corpses, the corpses of these men, brief billboard status because he knew he might be accused of this deed. There's a lot of questioning going on right now in the kingdom. Those of the north might have said, this whole thing stinks to high heaven. It was too convenient for David. He therefore was the mastermind behind getting rid of Ishbosheth, his rival. Even the execution wouldn't quiet the skeptics. They would only respond that this was the way politicians work. They hire their hitmen with promise of reward and then knock off their hirelings to make themselves look clean. And so David, the servant of the Lord, distances himself from these kind of accusations by slaughtering these men and putting them up on display to humiliate their deeds and what they were doing and deter anyone from thinking or doing such things. Quickly, what does this really have to do with all of us besides some subsequent points? David here serves as a type Christ. As we began this service, talking about how the Lord will reveal the hidden deeds of sinful men, David serves as a type Christ. He serves as encouragement to God's people in an age where Christ's flock will be continually wronged and crushed, tempted to be dealt with deceitfully and so forth. The church may be tempted to despair. This reminds us that God will never be fooled. David discerns the evil taking place that was cloaked as unrighteousness, or cloaked as righteousness. And so there's coming a reckoning day where the sovereign gaze of God will penetrate the hearts of all men and expose their evil deeds, particularly those that were done deceptively in the name of righteousness. Let us remember also, as David serves as a type Christ, he is not the true Christ. You know, in thinking about this, we all want to applaud David for what he's done. He's taken these two scoundrels and exposed them for what they are. Selfish, opportunistic deceivers. Only doing what seems to be righteous for their own benefit. And David exposes it. He sees through it. And he rids their influence from the empire, from the nation. And we want to applaud David. And we're ready to say, yes, David serves as a type Christ. But remember, thinking about this, David is not only serving as a type Christ, but he's also fully human. He's also sinful. Therefore, he is not the true Christ. Let us be careful and not heap too much praise upon David. He is a sinner in which sinners are not to put their, not, in whom we are not to put our hopes in. Even in David's righteous actions, he does not remain completely righteous. Keep something in mind. I like what Gordon Kitty writes here. Listen to this. If you've missed everything, don't miss this. Gordon Kitty writes, quote, "For David, in dealing with the sons of Rimmon, this was an open and shut case. Clearly they were sinfully motivated. David exposes it, exposes them for what they truly were, who they truly were, and he executes them, open and shut. They killed an innocent man, therefore their blood is required, and they must be destroyed from the earth. But it is striking to compare David's just severity with the sons of Rimmon to his unwillingness to deal with Joab, who, according to his own assessment, unjustly killed Abner. Joab was no better, his deeds were no better than the deeds of these men. That he deceived Abner, took him out to the city gates, stabbed him in the stomach as an act of vengeance upon his own brother, and opportunism, because now Abner is seen as a rival to General Joab. Get Abner out of the way. I maintain my position in the military and also avenge my brother's death. Now you look at Rechab and Baanah, avenging the deaths of their former citizenry of Beeroth. Now we can strike at Saul's household. And also seen as an opportunity to get reward and position. Yet David executes these two men and lets Joab get away with simply a curse. David seems a bit selective when it came to executing such justice. But here's what we are to note. He is righteous, but far from perfect. I give you this to exalt the one who is perfect in executing his justice. The Lord Jesus will bring justice down like mighty waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. He is perfect in the execution of his judgments. He is not tempted by the fleshly and selfish ways of men. He is completely fair, completely equitable, just. This reminds us that a reckoning day is coming where all evil will be exposed and nothing will be hidden before the judge of the universe. God's people must be assured that the time will come when the true Davidic king will institute such justice throughout the universe. There is no power that can overcome his kingdom, no folly that can thwart his ways, no injustice that would establish his kingdom. We look to Christ and Christ alone, and let us be encouraged and endure. Be patiently faithful, as God is not so unjust to overlook the evil perpetrated against his own people. He reigns, he will judge, and he will repay. While we can applaud David for certain things here, we do not praise him because he remains a sinful man. But it points us to our need of the true Messiah, the Lord Jesus. May God add blessing to the reading, hearing, and proclamation of His Word.